Is it true for everyone that God first offers us the easy way, but if we refuse, we must learn the hard way? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author. This week we are continuing our series in the biblical book of Isaiah. My conversation partners are again Jody Washburn and Matilda Fry, both teachers in the Walla Walla University School of Theology. Now, let's go to that question that I asked right at the beginning. Does God first offer us the easy way, but if we refuse, we must learn the hard way? What do you think? Does God give up very easily, one try and that's it? Or do you have different models in Scripture? For example, I have often been troubled how Saul didn't seem to get much of a chance at all. He was tossed out. Yet David got all kinds of chances. And furthermore, if I were going to vote for somebody for king, I would vote for Jonathan, hands down, over David. I mean, Jonathan was a man of integrity. So, coming back to the question, does God work differently with different people?
Well, maybe that is true. I do think that as we have a different way of approaching the way we learn, the way we grow in our lives. And we see that already when we have children, when they are small, we see the difference in them. Some learn by and understand, even when you just tell them, look, pay attention to this, do not do that, this is dangerous if you touch it, and so on. And others need to do it themselves, need to feel it, and then experience it, right? So I think God has ways and methods with each one in different ways, and King Ahaz surely is an example of that.
Yeah. Now, one of the questions that I have, when a leader goes astray, as Ahaz did, is it inevitable that those whom he leads also go astray? Now, we raised this question earlier about the relationship between strong civil leadership and strong religious leader, but is it inevitable that the people will go astray if their king goes astray?
We could extrapolate the other direction from, you know, our modern context, which we can also see in stories such as Ahab and Jezebel and the way that their leadership is described, and how, you know, in Ahab and Jezebel's example, you have a description of this widespread buying into what's described as bringing Baal and the foreign gods into Israel. And I mean, that's not an unknown thing. We can look right now at our society or at a number of points in history and see how easily language or ways of orienting oneself in relation to other groups of people can be modeled by a leader and then easily filter down. So I think absolutely there's an impact. There's also always a minor voice. You know, there's always a contingent that is holding out for a different reality, a different hope, a daring to believe things could be better.
I've always been intrigued by the story of Elijah, who felt that he was almost totally alone when he came down from Mount Carmel. He stood outside the cave there at Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, and he says, I am the only one that's left. And God says, oh, now wait a minute. I still have 7,000 people who've not bowed the knee to Baal. And so it was a reminder that, yes, there can be many good people who don't necessarily follow the lead of a bad king. Now, another question that I want to raise here, the question of the call to live in the fear of the Lord, and the New Testament statement that perfect love casts out fear. Was fear a more prominent feature of the Old Testament? And I'm not talking about fear in the sense of reverence. I'm talking about teeth-chattering, bone-chilling fear, where you're just really scared to death. Does that play a larger role in the Old Testament than in the New? Now, I know some people are reluctant to admit that. I've given a quotation here from Deuteronomy 5, but one of my great friends, now deceased, Malcolm Maxwell, when he would tell the story of Mount Sinai, it was always such a gentle piece, and he loved to play with the Hebrew and said the Hebrew has no negative commands, and you can read the Ten Commandments as simply descriptions. If you love me, you won't kill, you won't steal, and so on. And I said, Malcolm, you need to go back and read the text because the people were scared to death. And I put that into our lesson today. I think it would be a good idea simply to hear what happens, because sometimes the Lord does use fear to shake people up. This is Deuteronomy 5, 22 to 35. These words the Lord spoke with a loud voice to your whole assembly at the mountain, out of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness, and he added no more. He wrote them on two stone tablets and gave them to me. When you heard the voice out of the darkness while the mountain was burning with fire, you approached me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders. And you said, look, the Lord our God has shown us his glory and greatness, and we have heard his voice out of the fire. Today we have seen that God may speak to someone and the person may still live. So now why should we die? For this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of the Lord our God any longer, we shall die. For who is there of all flesh that has heard the voice of the living God, speaking out of the fire as we have and remained alive? Go near, you yourself, and hear all that the Lord our God will say. Then tell us everything that the Lord our God tells you, and we will listen and do it. The Lord heard your words when you spoke to me, and the Lord said to me, I have heard the words of this people which they have spoken to you. They are right in all that they have spoken. If only they had a mind such as this to fear me and to keep all my commandments always, so that it might go well with them and with their children forever. Go say to them, return to your tents, but you stand here by me, and I will tell you all the commandments, the statutes and the ordinances that you shall teach them, so that they may do them in the land that I am giving them to possess. So it seems to me that you read that text, God says, you're scared to death. That's good. I hope you remember that. Now, am I overstating the case there?
I think a little. I do think.
I have a hard time with the generalization of the fear, sort of like the fear as in terrified, i.e. this is a bad experience. And I don't know, I was sitting here trying to think, where does my discomfort with that delineation come from? And I think it has something to do with the recent work that's been done the last 10 years or so on awe and wonder, because this is something social psychologists can measure, and it can be elicited by a terrifying experience. It can be elicited by an encounter with incredible beauty, and it elicits the same reaction, usually described as some kind of combination of a small sense of self. You feel small, like you've suddenly become part of something much larger than yourself. And also, at the same time, people describe this like wanting to be connected with others, some sort of relational sort of bolstering. And so I have a hard time saying we have to talk about, you know, is it this bad kind of fear or is it reverence? Because in a way, these are maybe two sides of one human experience. I don't know.
Well, at least according to the story, which we have in Exodus chapter 20, in that part, Moses tells the people, this did not happen so that you should be afraid, but the fear of God should be with you.
And that would be one that I read then as awe, like an overwhelming sense of wonder.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm softening it. Maybe my tender heartedness is causing me not to see the the extreme fear.
Well, if you look at Jesus' story, this is really quite significant, because Jesus never attacked anyone. He never killed anyone. In fact, Reynolds Price says, it's a great line, he says, when Jesus cleansed the temple, He attacked the furniture, not the people. So people will respond in different ways, and I think we need to understand that.
I see the same kind of two sides of one coin as far as fear and terror versus awe and a sense of smallness in Jesus. I mean, wouldn't you be terrified of someone who was willing to die, right? To give in to the oppressive power of the Romans in order to overturn that system. And this is no weakling, the way the New Testament talks about Jesus.
And of course, I think of Peter after that great catch of fish. He fell on his face, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man." So it was a miracle, no overt attempt here to make him afraid. Mm-hmm. But his response was just one of awe, any way you look at it. Well, I think that some people do respond more to fear than others. I think if everyone in the world was like my wife, we wouldn't need any judges, no policemen, nothing. She's incredibly sensitive. And the introduction to my little book, Who's Afraid of the Old Testament God, says it pretty well. Dedicated to my gentle wife, Wanda, who does not enjoy reading the Old Testament in spite of all my arguments and explanations. But there are very few people in the world that are like my wife. In fact, she told a story once when she had taken some crayons and had drawn on the white wall in her bedroom. And she said she got a spanking for it. And she says, "I don't know why they spanked me. All they needed to do was tell me not to do it, and I wouldn't have done it." But again, some people need more of a stick, and others need to be dealt with in a more gentle way. Our time is up. Next week, we will be talking about the noble Prince of Peace, Isaiah 9-12. Grateful thank you to Jody and Matilda for their contribution to our conversation today. My thanks to Luke Irvine, who assisted with the recording, and to Rick Baskett, our program engineer. And a grateful thank you to all of you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.